Support for WPR comes from WIPS with Toward One Wisconsin, a conference on equity, diversity, and inclusion, May 7th and 8th in Eau Claire. Registration information and more is at t1w.org.
Last week, in Kevin McKinley's absence, we had a tax man on, a CPA, who answered your tax preparation questions. And today, Kevin is back with some bigger picture advice about tax time, and he will answer all of your personal finance questions as well at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8.5 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Tuesday, February the 7th. Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, with offices in Eau Claire and Madison, and he joins us from our studios in Eau Claire. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Joy.
So did you go to Tahiti or something last week?
I spent about a week on the lovely beaches of Captiva Island in Florida.
I love that place. Wow, that sounds nice. And welcome back. Good to have
you
back.
Thank you.
Now we're going to talk some taxes, though. I'm getting all my junk together, Kevin.
It's not junk, Joy. The stuff is very important to me. It's my livelihood here. Okay?
I know.
Maybe junk to you.
I am getting together my important tax forms and documents, and we are going to cover all things related to preparing and paying our income taxes this hour. Very important. It's going to be an interesting year, you say?
Yeah, because tax planning is extremely important for many people, especially the older we get, and especially in these times. You know, there aren't a lot of things that one can do to increase one's investment returns without taking on a lot more risk. So in both what we talk about here on the show and in my private practice, I like to focus and predicate people's success on lowering your taxes, reducing the expenses that you can reduce. The problem is that in the contentious political environment in which we currently reside and apparently are going to live in for the rest of our lives, there is a lot of uncertainty about what tax measures will be taken, what will be canceled, what will be revised or renewed in future years. So with this constant change, it makes it very difficult to plan for the long term and to find out if you should, you know, pay your taxes now or defer it later. And so we're going to try to answer some of those questions today for people.
Sounds good. Why don't you start with giving us some of the various numbers behind individual income taxes.
If it makes you feel any better, there are a lot of other Americans going through and putting together their junk right now. There are 137 million federal income taxes returns that will be filed for this year, for the 2011 tax year. Those are people who have positive adjusted gross income. The average that those people will pay per return is about $6,300, and the people who will be getting a refund, that average will be about $3,000 or so. Now, the federal income tax brackets can go up into the mid 30 percentile, but the average of income paid to the federal government by individuals is about 11% of their income. So when people say, oh, my taxes are so high, they're actually all about 11% of overall individual income is going to the federal government. And in terms of how the government brings that revenue in, individual income taxes cover about 45% of the federal income, 36% of that is from payroll taxes, and about 12% of that comes from corporate income taxes. But when people say their taxes are very high, that could be it. Typically, though, that just means they're higher than people would like them to be. Right now, individual income taxes constitute 14% of United States gross domestic product. That's the lowest ratio in the last 60 years.
So how have the figures changed over recent years?
For most people, as we said, the federal income taxes have gone down. In prior years, in the 1950s, people paid about 6% of their income, and it got up to as high as about 12% of income for a middle-income family of four in 1980. And for a middle-income family of four now, it's down to about 5% of income. But what people are really noticing is their paychecks are getting smaller because a greater portion of their money and their checks are going to Social Security and Medicare taxes, and then overall taxes. taxes are rising in general. Sales tax rates, property taxes are going through the roof, and even with the housing prices going down, it doesn't seem like the assessors and the people who established the mill rates have actually caught up and learned that there is a housing crisis. So it seems like property taxes are still high relative to the value of the homes. And then state and local taxes also seem to be eating up a lot of our income as well. But still, overall taxes, even when you throw state and local in there as well, 27% of all money goes to taxes. That's the lowest ratio in the last 40 years as well.
Interesting with that in perspective. So what do you think the future is going to bring in terms of any big changes to the way taxes are levied or paid?
Well, we kind of have two dynamics in place here. One is your own personal taxes, meaning what you pay, and those will probably be similar and then be less in retirement if the tax code stays similar to what it is. But you also have a legislative issue as well, and it's very politically popular to start coming up with different ideas for taxes because they're going to tax people who maybe you feel should be taxed more or taxed less, and also going to be taxed in different ways to discourage behavior. I think revenue will definitely be increased just because it needs to be increased. We might see an increase in what is known as the carried interest tax. This is what hedge fund managers and private equity managers pay on profits that they have. It's currently taxed at a very low rate. We might see some kind of transaction tax like the Tobin tax, which we've discussed. A lot of people talk about the need for a flat tax. We do kind of have that already in place in terms of the alternative minimum tax. There could be an internet transaction tax, especially for state residents. The Department of Revenue for the state of Wisconsin sent out a letter recently and said, hey, people, if you made transactions, especially with places like eBay or Amazon.com, we'd really like you to go through those transactions over the last few years and pay the state taxes that you technically do owe on those purchases that you've made. They estimated that $62 million will be owed and not paid by Wisconsin residents in 2012. But finally, what thing that's definitely going to happen, it's really going to affect people as they're filing their taxes, is the federal government wants to fill the tax gap. That's the amount that is technically owed by individuals by not paid. Currently, individuals pay on average about 85% of the actual taxes owed, but the number is so huge. It's about $400 billion this year, and that's about $2,500 per return. So the government's going to try a better job of not only educating, but also enforcing and making sure that the laws that are established are followed.
Well, Kevin, I'm so glad that you got in a lovely vacation last week because you're not going to have a moment's rest between now and April 15th, are you?
No, and I thank heaven for it because that's what I get paid to do, and I'm very fortunate. But yes, you're right. This is an extremely busy time for us, but that's like asking a firefighter while he or she is holding a hose of, you're really stressed out right now. Yes, but this is what I get paid to do.
There we go. Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. You should consult with your financial advisor prior to making any investment decisions. That being said, if you have a question for Kevin about a money matter, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. And, you can have tax-related questions this hour, but also any personal finance questions are also welcome. It's time now for our On Your Money email bag. Several listeners, Kevin, have asked about the possibility of being audited by the IRS and the consequences of getting that dreaded letter from the IRS. Do we have reason to worry?
It's one of those many issues where the fear of an audit far exceeds both the likelihood of it actually happening and the effect. And keep in mind, the IRS is a demonized organization, but I've dealt with them several times on behalf of clients, and they're just doing their job. It's much like getting mad at a state trooper for giving you a speeding ticket, and it's not the state trooper's job to decide, really what the law should be. It's a state trooper's job to enforce the laws. If they catch you speeding, you're probably going to get some kind of citation. the same thing with the IRS. They don't decide, you know, who pays taxes. They don't get any, you know, percentage or anything. And as a matter of fact, they're woefully understaffed right now. The reasons for IRS audits are, first of all, so that they can get the money that an individual owes, but also so that they can kind of get an idea of a person's situation and figure out how that applies to a broader base of similar taxpayers here. People who have $1 million in income have the good fortune of having the likelihood of about 1 in 8 of those types of returns will get audited. But if you have a little over $200,000 in income, the chance of an audit drops down to 1 in 25. And if you have less than $200,000 in income, you have less than a 1 in 100 chance of actually being audited. But there are still some further ways, if this does alarm you, to reduce the chances of being audited and any eventual harm to you that may come of that.
Are there some common audit triggers?
If the deductions in income for someone in your situation, you know, your income, your assets, your career really jump out, meaning you have low income for a doctor, let's say, or you have very high deductions and you're, you know, a middle class person. Small business owners and expenses increase the chances that you're probably going to get checked out even further. If you have very large charitable deductions and they're kind of a questionable nature, and then you know, people even who don't make a ton of money can also be subject to it as well. Waitresses, waiters, servers of various types who get paid a lot of cash and tips sometimes get audited, and they say, you know, I only make $30,000 a year. Why am I audited? Well, it's because the IRS wants to get the word out there that you have to report those tips. It is income, and we know you don't make any money, but you still have to report it. You probably won't be taxed very heavily on it, so just report it and go from there.
So would it be a questionable charitable donation if I gave money to Wisconsin Public Radio? What's questionable?
No, the IRS smiles favorably on that, actually. And once they see that on your return, they typically not only stop the audit right there, but give you a smiley face sticker on your return. That's a qualified deduction. It's perfectly standard. And the IRS generally just goes through and says, you know, yes, no, yes, no, yes, no. Mm-hmm. And what the best way to avoid this is, first of all, to try to pay all the taxes that you're legally obligated to. Keep very good receipts if you do donate to Wisconsin Public Radio. Make sure you keep the receipt and the record for that. Account for everything, all that blizzard of paperwork you're dealing with right now. Try to make sure that everything that's going to the IRS from a third party is also matches up with what you submit to the IRS as well. And finally, check your math. One of the biggest reasons that still the audit letters come or the examination letters come from the IRS is that people add up their returns in pencil and they, you know, don't carry the 7 or something like that, and all of a sudden the numbers don't match. The IRS says, hey, the numbers don't match. Why is that?
Because I did them. What if we file our taxes and then receive a notice from the IRS?
You should not panic. It's not a happy day when you see that little logo up in the upper left-hand corner of the letter you receive. You definitely want to respond quickly and say, you know, call the IRS and say, I want to find out what's going on here and what you're concerned about and what the next steps are. You may want to contact a CPA or a tax attorney if you don't have one already. And sometimes I've had several people who have gone through audits, and in the midst of the audit, the auditor finds out that the people actually should be getting a refund back, and they should be paying even less taxes than what they thought. The IRS is much more concerned with accuracy than they are with just increasing the amount of revenue that comes in. Now, if you do end up owing something, you just only end up owing what you would have had to owe anyway. You might pay a little bit in penalties, and again, they might actually get a larger refund from the audit. So don't necessarily fear it out of hand.
I don't actually do my own taxes, but I am looking forward to coming up a little bit later during On Your Money. Kevin will have some advice on choosing a tax preparer, and we'll talk more about that later in the program. Now, time for some of your questions, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Chris in Menominee is with us first. Hello, Chris.
Hi, Joy. Hi, Kevin.
Hi.
I'm calling because I'm out of college now. I'm working full-time, make about $38,000 a year. My wife still got about a year left of school, and our lease is up in August on the apartment that we rent. We pay about $570 a month, and we only have to pay for the electricity that's used there. Now, I'm gonna be making more money as soon as I go billable at my job, and I'm wondering if I should start looking at, you know, maybe looking into purchasing a house soon, or if I should stick out with the renting a few more years.
To rent or to buy, Kevin?
I'm sorry, Chris. Do you think you are going to be staying in this area in which you currently live?
Yeah, I live about an hour from the Twin Cities, and I drive every day to work. It's quite a bit of driving. We're going to be moving closer towards the Minnesota border.
Okay, just don't go over the border to live, because terrible things can happen if you go venture outside the boundaries of our great state. The issue of the timing, as I would say, if you do find something you really, really like, whoa, this is it, there's nothing better, let's just dive in and do this thing. But saying in terms from a financial standpoint, like, you know, we're only losing this money to rent every single year, we should be start building up equity in a home or get in while prices are good or rates are good. All those things could be true, but you won't find out for about 10 years if it was actually a really good time, both in the marketplace and in terms of your lives to buy. There are places closer to the Minnesota border, Chris, where your $570 will not even cover the monthly property tax bill, much less the mortgage payment, plus all the insurance and the upkeep and everything. And I know there are people actually listening right now saying, hey, where does this guy live? I will trade my house and my mortgage for this place that he has for $570 a month. And I bet it's, you know, it's not a horrible place. It's certainly
all right. Thank you.
Yeah, so I'd hang on for a little while and do what you can from that standpoint.
Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner, and he is here to answer your questions. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Every time it rains, man is from heaven.
Shoo-be-doo-be.
Don't you know each cloud contains banners from heaven?
You're listening to On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And coming up a little bit later on this tax edition of On Your Money, we'll talk about how to increase the accuracy of your income tax filing and reduce the final amount owed. I'm Joy Cardine, along with Kevin McKinley, certified financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. We welcome all of your personal finance questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Our next caller is Larry in Stevens Point. Hi, Larry.
Hi, good morning. Real quick side trip here. The one time I was audited, I got money back.
Yay.
There you go.
You know, it works that way. I had a couple questions about gifting for your children. Amounts, do they have a tax liability, and is there any form or paperwork involved?
If you're gifting to my children? We're going to make this as easy as possible, Larry. I bless you. If you're gifting to your kids, you can gift up to $13,000 per person per year and from the giver or the grantor, if you will. And so what that means is that, let's say a husband and wife wanted to gift money to their adult children who happen to be husband and wife. The older generation can give $26,000 total to the couple and per person, so they can give $52,000 a year without any tax consequences. Now, if you go over that amount, that $13,000 per year, there still may be no tax liability, but you have to and you should file a gift tax return, because you get a lifetime gift exemption of several million dollars. It's probably way more than anyone listening will ever go through. But you still should file the return, because the IRS wants to track that to make sure you don't use up that exemption over time as a way to get out of estate taxes. So yes, you can give $13,000 per year to any person, including your children, and still not have to incur any gift tax form filing or any gift tax.
The gift tax return, is that a standard IRS document?
Yeah, I think it's 709, Form 709. But if you just go gift tax return, Google that in the IRS.gov website, Larry, I think you'll find that.
Okay, super. Thank you, Kevin.
Thanks for the call, Larry. Ruth in Wausau is with us now. Hello, Ruth.
Hello. We have stock in several companies, and for some of them, we have paper certificates of the stock. And I read someplace that that's not a good idea. What is your opinion?
It's actually a very, it's a good question, Ruth, and it's very, there's not an easy answer to it, as I'm proving right now. The The benefits of doing that are that you have the stock, and no one else can take it away from you as long as you have the shares. And in these days of people being more suspicious of large organizations and what happens to your securities, I'm not concerned in by and large about you putting your securities in with a large brokerage firm or something and having it held in what's known as electronic form. But sometimes it just feels better to have those shares in, say, a safe or a safety deposit box. Now, the advantages of having it filed in electronic form at a custodian or at some kind of investment firm or brokerage firm are that you're going to hear more about splits, about other types of communications that have to come through in terms of special dividends that they may not be able to track you, and they'll probably have a better record of what's going on it than you will by just receiving the check on your own. But there may be fees that you incur to have that, and there could be further fees on top of it for any activity. For instance, if you bring a stock down to some brokerage firm and say, I want you to hold this for me in an account, they may charge you $50 or $100 to receive it in. Then if you go back a year later and say, you know what, give me the shares back, they might charge you another $50 or $100 to take it back out. One way around this, kind of a happy medium between handing it over to some investment company and keeping it on your own in the in a cardboard box, is to have contact each individual company. Let's say it's a Caterpillar company, and they have a register, a bank that actually holds all their individual securities for you. And it's usually a very small fee to do so, if there's any fee at all. And you also can have those shares reissued to you at any time. So you might want to call them and say, will you hold the shares for me? What's the cost to transfer the shares in and keep them? So you end up getting statements every single year with the dividends. If you want to have the shares reinvested, you can do that as well. And that's kind of a happy medium between the two.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right, Ruth. Thanks. Good luck to you. That makes sense to me. Eric in Appleton. Hello, Eric.
Good morning. I love your show. And I don't have a question, but I wanted to respond to a statement that Kevin made earlier in the program when he was talking about property taxes and property tax burdens and how assessors often lag behind market trends with regard to rendering their assessments. And I am a municipal assessor here in Wisconsin.
Uh-oh.
Well, then you automatically know more about it than I do, Eric.
All right. But I work all over the state. And I just want to point out to your listeners that in Wisconsin, property tax collections are not tied to property values. Surprise, surprise. So the reason the system is set up that way is so that in a declining market, let's say we have a hypothetical situation where property values in Wisconsin have fallen by 50% across the board. And in response to this, the local assessors lower everyone's property assessments by 50%. Well, that doesn't mean that all the municipalities are going to take a 50% pay cut or cut their budgets by 50%, they're going to double the tax rate and collect the same amount that they paid or that they collected last year. So individual tax bills are determined by the percentage that
the need, if you will, the need of the municipality.
Well, that's the overall, but the individual the individual tax bill is determined not by the amount of the tax assessment in itself, but rather the percentage of the whole that individual assessed value represents. So assessments are really a quantifier more than anything else.
I'm not sure I followed that entirely. My property taxes on my little dinky ranch home are less than some other big rich mansion.
Certainly.
Eric.
Well, that's absolutely true. Your assessed value, more than being what your property is worth, in other words, represents your piece of the pie. The value that the pie represents is irrelevant, but it's the size of the piece that determines your tax bill.
This is true, but the number, if the number is irrelevant, I would wish that that they wouldn't go through the whole charade of saying that this is an assessed value of your home. Now, I get that it's I don't even know how someone like you can do your job and answer to all the people who you have pushing and pulling on you to try to say, come in with a fair number of this and generate the revenue that the municipality obviously needs to go, and then do it from a year-to-year basis based on the vagaries of the housing market. But it's not your responsibility, obviously, to just say, oh, you know what, housing prices are down 10%. I'm going to knock $30,000 off your assessment.
Well, under the law, the assessor's job is to assess at market value or within 10% of it. The trouble with that is everyone has a different opinion of value. That's why the more important part of the job is equity of assessments, which means assessing like properties in a similar fashion and applying, relative to each other.
Got it. Good help, Eric. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
Eric, and Eric, you may want to actually listen in, because we are going to be talking in a few weeks about making sure that your property tax, that your assessed value and then the amount that you're paying in property taxes is correct. Let's just say correct and accurate.
I'll be listening. I listen every week. I love your show. Thanks again.
Thanks, Eric. I bet you Eric will be calling in again then. No, thanks for clarifying that, and good luck to you.
Yeah,
Eric.
That was helpful.
Cheryl in Milwaukee.
It's good, actually, to get some helpful information on this show once in a while.
It's a nice surprise. Cheryl in Milwaukee, you're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Good morning.
My question has to do with the fact that I am in my late 30s. I am trying to get pregnant. I have yet to start any kind of retirement plan because I have spent the last 3 years getting out of the debt that I acquired in my 20s. Cool. As of this fall, I will be completely out of debt.
Yay.
Good for you.
So I'm trying to figure out, how do I start to do that in the least scary way, because I don't know a lot about it.
Well, sadly, Cheryl, if this were, you know, the 1800s or early 1900s, having a baby would be your retirement plan. You just, you know, have this baby and this kid takes care of you in your old age and then gently, you know, launches you out onto an ice floe and can't take care of you anymore. But this is not the late 1800s or early 1900s. So here's what I would say. First of all, good for you. That discipline that you've demonstrated, it's much harder to get out of debt from your 20s than it is to actually save retirement in your 30s, even when you're trying to have a baby and do all these other things. So what I would do, do you have a job right now, Cheryl?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Do you have an at-work retirement plan?
Yes, we do, which is why most people look at me crazy that I haven't started to do anything.
Well, you know, that's not crazy. That's just an issue of saying, you've had other priorities and you still have other priorities, and it's easy to say, hey, well, these are something, you know, I'm staring 18% interest for my credit cards right in the face right now. Something that might or might not happen 35 years from now is a little difficult to prioritize in light of that current condition. The same thing with trying to have children, which, you know, having a baby is actually the cheap part. It's raising the dumb kid that is really expensive. So here's what I would say. If you need the discipline of a little bit pulled out of your paycheck every single month, definitely roll into the plan. Try it for a few months. Take out, you know, 5% of your salary. See if you can survive. And if you can, that's probably the best and easiest way to do it. But if you say, you know what, I just need every single penny close at hand right now, then I would suggest you open up a Roth IRA for yourself, because you don't get a tax deduction on the deposit. But you can always pull the contribution to the Roth IRA back out at any time for any reason with no taxes or penalties whatsoever. It also makes a very convenient ersatz college savings plan for that reason as well for middle income parents. So start with a Roth IRA. You can open one at any credit union or bank, or call up, you know, a company like Vanguard or Schwab or Fidelity, and they'll be happy to open one up for you. And just a lot of people, once they know they can pull that money out, it's easier for them to actually contribute to it in the first place. And most people don't end up pulling it out, but that's a really good way to save for retirement now without having to worry about, you know, losing that money technically for 20 or 30 years.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Cheryl. If you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner, Managing Member of McKinley Money, LLC, and it is time for the Smart Assets segment of our show. Most of what you owe for the 2011 income tax year is already determined, but Kevin says there are a few things that you can do to increase the accuracy of your filing and reduce your final amount. How so, Kevin?
Well, in terms of the accuracy, there's a new change for the 2011 tax year. And it's part of that effort to fill in that tax gap that we mentioned previously. It involves the cost basis for securities that you have sold in 2011, especially that you purchased in the same year, and that's stocks or mutual funds and even bonds that are held outside of a retirement account. So if you don't hold any assets outside of retirement accounts like IRAs, Roth IRAs, and 401ks, this doesn't apply to you. But if you did do any buying and selling in 2011 and then you plan on doing it again in the future, this will apply to you. Previously, you could use lots of different methods for establishing cost basis on a stock, and it was almost on the honor system. And the IRS determined that people were probably either willfully or accidentally not paying their entire tax bill because they weren't getting the cost basis correct. So now they have the third-party reporting cost basis to the IRS for various shares that you've bought and sold. And there's a Form 8949 you're probably going to get in the mail if you haven't already for any transactions. And you have to use that cost basis number for that particular security for your 2011 returns.
So what are some other ways that we can save on 2011's taxes?
Best way for most people to do is making sure that you're maxing out all that you can into your retirement plan contributions. If you're in a higher income, you definitely want to use the tax-deductible IRA if you can, meaning you're not also in a higher income bracket and qualified for a plan at work, like we talked about with Cheryl. You can put up to $5,000 per person per year into that plan and up to $6,000 if you're over 50. If you're already maxing out an at-work plan and you're eligible, you want to switch to a Roth IRA. You won't save any money now on the deposits, but you will shelter earnings in the future, and then the withdrawals are tax-free. Don't forget that if you're making an IRA contribution and you have a stay-at-home spouse, you can also make a contribution on that person's behalf as well to both an IRA or either an IRA or a Roth IRA. And if you're in a lower income bracket, even if you make a contribution to a Roth IRA, you might still get some money back on it, even though it's not tax deductible under the savers credit. Now, it's not a lot. It might only be a few hundred dollars, but it can really make a difference and give you a great incentive to make a little bit of a contribution to that if you can. And finally, self-employed people can still open up SEP plans by April 15th or October 15th if they file an extension. And if you have the cash and the eligibility, it's a great way to lower your taxes for 2011.
Okay, so how about some non-retirement savings ideas?
We are seeing a much more predominance of healthcare savings accounts. These are savings accounts that you make tax-deductible contributions to, and they're paired with high-deductible plans. You want to max those out if you possibly can and have the cash, especially if you're going to have some medical expenses coming up that you can use that and pull it out tax-free. If you do have medical expenses that weren't covered by insurance and weren't covered out of an HSA, sometimes married couples where one individual has a very high level of out-of-pocket medical expenses in a given year, it makes sense for them to actually do the married filing separately so that you can apply the medical expenses to the person who had incurred them, and because they exceed the 7.5% of income, they're deductible. The earned income tax credit is something a lot of people miss, especially in the lower brackets. And finally, the sales tax issue. You can often deduct sales taxes. You can choose to deduct sales taxes or state income taxes against your federal level. Most Wisconsin residents already pay a fairly high level of state income taxes, but if you had a sales tax on a really, really big purchase like a motorhome or something, sometimes it's better off to use that as a deduction instead.
Okay. What should be done if filers cannot pay what they owe?
The IRS even says on their own website at irs.gov, with all that official language, the first words they say if you can't pay your taxes is don't panic. And they have a topic on their page. It's topic 202 at irs.gov that is devoted specifically to people in this instance. You definitely still need to file, but you should contact the IRS as soon as possible. Go to 800-829-1040 on the phone or go to irs.gov to find out if you have an office near you and say, I owe this amount of taxes. I can't pay it right now. What are my options? You can put it on a credit card. You may be able to get a loan like a home equity loan or borrow against a vehicle or get a personal loan. You can pull money out of a retirement plan to pay this, but you're going to incur taxes in some cases or jeopardize yourself. I would just recommend you go directly to the IRS and say, what are the payment plan options? Because they have payment plans that are actually They can avoid fees, but not interest. But the interest rate is relatively low and usually lower than what you would pay from these other sources. So go to the IRS and say, I can't pay this right now. You will not be the first person that called the IRS, and even in that minute, much less that day, saying, I owe these taxes. I can't pay it right now. What are my options? And they'll lay out what you can do to make sure that you don't get in any further trouble and that your fees and interest are as low as possible.
So what if we're receiving a refund, though? What are our choices there?
You have more options than ever before, and there's a neat new wrinkle, especially that fans of On Your Money will appreciate. The notion of getting these tax fund refund anticipation loans is going out the window. They've really clamped down on this. As a matter of fact, H&R Block doesn't offer them anymore, and this will be the last year that those are even legally allowed. You can get a check. Some places give people a prepaid debit card for the amount charged up with the amount of the refund if you don't have a bank. And obviously, you can get direct deposit. You can split them up in several different accounts if you weigh. But we've talked about Series I savings bonds and how the limits are $10,000 per person per year. These are really great, very safe investments, and they pay a little bit of yield. Well, another way to go over that $10,000 limit is to get your tax refund in the form of a Series I savings bond. You can get another up to $5,000 from that if you get the refund in the form of the bond. You have to fill out a special form for it, but it's a way that people can put even more money aside into these very safe investments. And you go to irs.gov and we'll have a link to that page that explains how you can go about that.
Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. We'll get to more of your calls in just a moment. In fact, we'll get to one of your calls right now. Melissa in Milwaukee is with us. Hello, Melissa.
Hello. Hi, Kevin. Hi, Joy.
Hi.
I have a refinance question. My husband and I are going to, we believe, refinance, and we're going to go from a 30-year to a 20-year term, and we're going to do that for a few reasons. One is to just have more spending power and to take advantage of that lower rate, and two is to get the, we're going to take out $20,000 to $25,000 to put it back into the house and in the kitchen, and then the third reason is because we have three kids and two are in college and one is heading there, so with tuition and cost of living, et cetera, we would like to have a little bit more money to help them out if needed, and it's likely that they will need it. So my question is, I haven't really shown strong financial judgments in the past, so I'm just...
Including listening to this show. Yeah, go ahead, right?
So I really wanted your opinion on, is this a good time to do it? Is this a good way to, you know, should we be helping the kids as much as we can, even though they're getting their FAFSA loans? I'm just feeling like it's crunch time, and now we're early 50s. Like, I'm 50, my husband's 52, both employed, but we just feel like every time we get a little bit ahead, we're slammed again, and then, so...
Yeah, I think it's for all the reasons you describe, Melissa, it's a great idea. And I would highly encourage you to do this, even though it goes against the grain of everything that, you know, your long-deceased great-grandparent dirt farmers would want you to do with your money. And it seems just extravagant. But to be going through this really crucial time, which a lot of people in your age cohort are experiencing, where trying to keep up with monthly expenses, trying to pay for college and try to save for retirement, you've got this huge amount of your percentage of your net worth tied up in this thing that, yes, you can, you know, technically live in the house and it's nice to save the interest costs and all that, but your bigger worries right now are liquidity, not interest costs, especially when long-term right. mortgage rates are under 4% and valuations are probably at the highest point that they're going to be, at least from the appraiser's value rather than the assessor's value. So I would definitely encourage you to do it. I would get the 30-year mortgage. I would get it for as much as the lender will allow. I would keep that money as safe and separate as you possibly can, because I wouldn't want you to drain that all down on things. You say, well, wait a minute, where did all that money go? So put it in a CD, put it in a savings bond.
Well, actually, what we're going to do is put it into our kitchen. We're going to redo the kitchen because we wanted to put it back into the house.
Right.
And this will be the third kitchen that we've redone as a way to, you know, the sweat equity part of it. So...
On this show, Melissa, when we don't have time to say sweat equity, we say swequity. But yes, go ahead. All right.
All right. Melissa, you were making a very wise financial decision there. So
yeah, I do. And it really is. And here's the dumb thing about it. Yes, the interest save you, but you are in that kitchen every day and for a long time during the day. It's probably command central of your home, especially if you have kids. So put the money in there. You'll get about 50 to 60 cents back on every dollar that you put into it. And plus, you enjoy it. So yeah, this is a time in your life where I really want to reduce your worry. And if reducing your worry means you increase the amount of interest you pay a little bit every single year, I'm all for it. And I would get the 30-year and totally keep the money as safe as you can. Don't go crazy with it. But yeah, the kitchen's fine. College is fine. All that stuff. But no, go ahead and do it.
Melissa, thanks very much for the call and good luck to you and your family. More of your calls in just a bit. Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner, Managing Member of McKinley Money, LLC. Our number, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, along with Certified Financial Planner Kevin McKinley. And Kevin, I'm wondering if I should pay to have somebody else do my taxes, or if I should bite the bullet and do them myself?
I lean toward paying somebody else to do it just because the cost versus the benefit is so low. You get a lot of benefit for relatively little cost. You can get a free version. If you do it yourself, I still run into people, very bright people who are comfortable, you know, having their whole life in an iPhone, but they still do their taxes with a pencil and paper. But you can go to providers. You can even qualify for that free file program from the IRS if you have $57,000 or less or income. Might have to pay a little bit more if you have a state tax form or an earned income tax credit. But it's still, you know, the cost of a dinner at a mid-priced restaurant. Go to irs.gov/free file to find out which programs qualify for the free form and what other costs you might incur in the process.
Even if I can't get the free stuff, that tax prep software, those programs aren't very expensive?
Not at all. And they're better than they ever were. They ask you questions, the same questions the way a tax preparer would say, you know, did you have any business expenses, et cetera, et cetera. And they have nice little dialogue boxes. And there even is some help underneath that. TurboTax costs about $30 to $40 for the individual form, a little bit more if you have rental property or business expenses. H&R Block is very similar to that as well. You can tailor your situation for about a couple hundred dollars or so at the very most to get a very nice presentation. And again, they still have some customer support and tax help available as an underlying feature from many of those paid programs.
What if you need help beyond what the programs provide?
Well, you can get a free answers from several different sources. First of all, you know, try to get in touch with the IRS. They'll tell you the answers as they see it. They have a new volunteer site location. We'll have a link up to that website at our website, onyourmoney.com, where there are several in Wisconsin where you can go and do your forms. But when you run into something, you can walk up to the desk and say, hey, how do I do this? And then go back and complete the form. There's that VITA, the Volunteer Income Tax form, where they'll for people with $50,000 or less of income, they'll help you, but they're not too stringent on the income restrictions. And then the TCE, this is Tax Counseling for the Elderly, which specifically is geared towards people who are 60 and over, who are willing to be called elderly, but they'll help anybody out as well. And again, if you go to irs.gov, you can find out where you can get that free help from these people.
What if I want to stick with a tax preparer, but I maybe want to switch tax preparers? How should I look for one?
Well, it doesn't have to be a CPA, but it probably should be. You can expect, you know, people are generally weary of paying for this stuff, but it's just so much easier to do, especially if you have a relatively complex situation, like you've had a big change in your life, a divorce or a change in job situation or something. It's going to cost you somewhere between $200 to $800 and typically more toward the $200 to $400 range for simple situations to actually go to a CPA. You should be very aware if you've got, you know, some kind of dodgy tax preparer saying, bring your money to me, I'll get you a larger refund than anybody else. Your refund is going to be your refund regardless of where you go, as long as the forms are prepared properly. If you are going to go to a person, you want to start as soon as possible because they're very busy right now and you only have 10 weeks until your taxes are due. So you can go to wicpa.org. That's Wisconsin's CPA Association. They have a CPA finder engine on that site. Or, again, you can go to irs.gov, and they have all their electronic filers, so you can see everyone in your zip code who is basically willing to do taxes and do them electronically, which almost all preparers do.
All right, sounds good. Let's see if we can fit a couple more calls in. Bill in Appleton is with us. Hello, Bill.
Hello. Kevin, I'm eligible for a traditional IRA contribution for 2011, and I know that I have until April 15th to make that, or maybe April 18th this year, to make that contribution.
But yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. My question is, can I file my return right away? I could file my return tomorrow, but can I still take that deduction if I haven't actually made the contribution on if I haven't made the contribution yet?
Yeah, you can just note it that you have done it. I mean, if there's ever an issue for it, if the numbers don't match up somehow, you might get audited, and they might say, "Hey, prove to us you really did make that contribution." But yes, you can, as long as you note that it's on there. Now, sometimes that can create a little problem because little hiccups can come up between now and then. Either you don't have the money, or there's some issue with how much money you can put in at the time, and so then you have to go back in and do it. I would actually recommend and prefer that you make the contribution as soon as possible, and then document that and send the form in. But no, in theory, you can do it by that date.
All right, Bill, thanks for the call. Don't forget, Bob in Fifield is with us. Hello, Bob.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead, please.
Yes, I had a question about sales tax, and I have one other question. I've saved all my receipts through the year of sales tax, and can I use that as a deduction?
Probably. Is it a substantial amount? Is it several thousand dollars, or is it, you know, the 8 cents when you bought a gallon of milk or something?
Coming up to it's probably several thousand dollars.
Okay. And how does that compare to your state income taxes?
I'll give you the other question before that. I'm an Illinois resident. That's my legal residence, and I moved back up to Wisconsin because we couldn't.
Because it's an awesome state,
right?
That's why.
Yeah,
exactly. Oh, I love Wisconsin. It is an awesome state. But I moved back up here because I had a house built up here a couple of years ago. My wife and I were divorced. Put the house up for sale, and in this market, we just haven't been able to sell it.
Okay, so you're filing, though, as an Illinois resident, right?
Yes.
Okay, I'll tell you what. We have the IRS has a sales tax deduction calculator, and we'll put that up at onyourmoney.com, and that'll actually tell you right away if and how and how much of those sales taxes can be deducted. Go to onyourmoney.com. Hopefully we'll get that later up this afternoon and check that out. But they have a really neat online tool at irs.gov that you can do to figure out if and how much you can actually deduct.
All right. Good luck to you, Bob. So time now for the website of the week, Kevin.
Well, the White House wants you to know where all these federal income taxes that you are paying are going. And so they have created a calculator at whitehouse.gov/tax receipt. Now, it is for the 2010 tax year. You can enter in your actual taxes paid for the year. They will have the 2011 one up in a few weeks. Or you can just say, well, here's my situation. How much of my money is going to each of these various areas? Now, they're very politically astute. So every single category is called something that you say, yeah, I want to do that. Like they'll say job training or healthcare or defense. It's like, yeah, definitely. You bet. I'm all for that. But go to whitehouse.gov/tax receipt to see where your money is going, at least from a federal standpoint. We'll have a link to that website up on our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
I'm going to check that out. And in our final minute, Kevin, is the IRS website worth a visit as we get rolling on our taxes?
I get a little baffled by it once in a while, but they're doing their best. There's so much information. And again, if you're confused by all the changes that are coming on from a political standpoint and a legislative standpoint, imagine what they're trying to do and how many, you know, there's 55 some thousand pages to the tax code, and they have to keep updating every single component of the website when a change comes through. So, I like it. It's not as easy to use as I'd like it to be, but it's still very useful.
Well, I hope you have a very fun tax season, Kevin. we have time for four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley is with us just about every Tuesday for On Your Money. He is a certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money LLC with offices in Eau Claire and in Madison. Thanks to Rob Ferret and to Bill Martins for producing this program. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.